Opposite the title page of James Cockcroft's new book is a picture of a Mexican man who lived from 1874 to 1922. Under the picture appears his name, Ricardo Flores Magón, and the phrase, early anarcho-communist revolutionary. Those words, that designation, sets the tone for Cockcroft's book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, which begins with the Great Revolution of 1910 to 1917 and concludes with current-day struggles, both within Mexico and among immigrants here in the U.S. The book examines the radical visions of the revolutionaries, the ideological roots of waves of Mexican resistance to that nation's elites, and the agendas of U.S. corporations and governments, and the elections-related turmoil that periodically plagues Mexico. James Cockcroft is a Montreal-based scholar, activist, and poet. He is internet professor for the State University of New York, and his other books include Intellectual Precursors of the Mexican Revolution and Imperialism, Neoliberalism, and Social Struggles in Latin America. James sat down with me in KPFA's Berkeley studios to discuss his new book, Mexico's Revolution, Then and Now. He began by describing how the Mexican people fared before 1910 under the Diaz dictatorship.
The people of Mexico did rather poorly. The bourgeoisie of Mexico and the oligarchy did very well. The people of Mexico, by which we mean the intermediate classes, the rich, the poor, the Indians, and the overexploited women of society, underwent what they called at the time modernization, welcoming of foreign capital to the extent that foreign capital, or the U.S. capitalists at least, owned, as I recall, 12% of the national territory.
By what year?
1910. But what happened was, after the predominantly Indian population defeated the French and Maximilian and liberated Mexico from foreign control, the Diaz dictatorship came in initially as a progressive government, as a liberal government that had defeated very conservative forces. General Diaz himself was the hero of the Battle of Puebla that we celebrate every year, including here in California. But he proceeded to eventually establish a dictatorship and get reelected year after year. So what happened, or election after election, so what happened is that the slogan of the 1910 revolution of Francisco E. Madero, who called it, was no reelection, you know. And the dictatorship hardened. It established a military special force called Rurales that oppressed the peasantry. The peasantry was driven down. Lands were concentrated in the hands of the big landowners even more than previously in Mexican history, and poverty set in. Also, Mexicans emigrated in large numbers to the United States. And then internally, Mexicans organized a workers' press, a pro-democracy, pro-working class press. And these newspapers led to occasional strikes in the 19th century and eventually became consolidated under the banner of the Mexican Liberal Party, founded in 1900, whose program was launched from exile, actually, because of the repression in St. Louis, Missouri in 1905. And that program became the ideological basis of the Mexican Constitution of 1917, what I call the paper triumph of the Mexican Revolution of the preceding years.
Ricardo Flores Magón was a deep thinker. He was a dynamic figure. He was a pivotal player in the Mexican Revolution. Who was Magón, and what political convictions were most dear to him?
The convictions that were most dear to him were what he called human emancipation. He, like many great thinkers in history and activists, he was an activist and organizer of armed revolts prior to 1910, and even a liberator of northern Baja California in 1911, where he established what they call the Comuna of Northern Baja, where all the means of production were seized by the workers under his leadership and that of the PLM, and the goods were distributed according to human need. A practice that was repeated by Zapata, by the way, in the commune of Morelos under the advice of Magonistas. I'll get to that later. But so Flores Magón himself was part Indian, or almost fully Indian, and like Benito Juarez, he went to Mexico City to get an education. His parents wanted him to get educated. One of his parents was actually in the military. And then when he got educated more, he was brilliant undoubtedly as a child, but as he got more educated, he got more political. So he became a kind of anarcho-communist in his ideology, which actually has a lot to do with traditional Indian culture in Mexico.
Very suspicious of the state?
Yeah, suspicious of the state. He was anti-state. He was sort of like Emma Goldman in the United States, who was one of his champions. But I want to emphasize that his communalistic ideas, with the idea of seizing the means of production and distributing the goods equally to everyone, according to human need, obviously, were rooted in collectivist traditions of Mexico Profundo, or Indian Mexico.
Means of production being factories, equipment, raw materials, that kind of thing.
Right. And the land itself should be communal. And indeed, out of that came the ejido system, the communal land system of the 1917 Constitution, since eliminated, by recent governments in Mexico. So that's who he was. He organized with his brothers. There were the brothers Flores Magón and several other people, organized strikes and revolts between 1906 and 1911. And most of them were in 1906, 7, and 8. By then, they were so crushed and so repressed and tortured and so on in prisons that the Magonistas were unable to mobilize to the degree that Madero and later Villa and Zapata were able to mobilize. Nonetheless, they continued to be an influential force as part of the Mexican Revolution.
To what extent did the Magón partisans, the Magonistas, to what extent did they think on an international level as opposed to merely in national terms?
This was probably what distinguished them most from any other group in the world at the time. They anticipated the activist internationalism of the later Bolshevik Revolution, or of Lenin and Trotsky, by practicing it. And the main membership of the party was Indian, okay? And another significant membership was Mexican immigrants in the United States. So the organization of Los de Abajo, the lower classes, by the PLM led to an internationalist praxis, not just in the commune of Northern Baja in 1911, but in the Cananea strike of 1906 and other strikes and in the armed revolts. So there was a constant flow of money and arms clandestinely between Mexicans in the southwest of the United States and Magonistas inside Mexico organizing the revolts and strikes. And, of course, there was a constant flow of information from the U.S. government and the Mexican government spying on these groups and arresting them and repressing them when they did strike on either side of the border. You should know that half of the contributions of the industrial workers of the world, the most prominent anarchist-oriented industrial workers organization in the United States at the time, came from Mexican immigrants. And that the strikes in the Southwest, right up through the Ludlow Massacre of 1914, were dominated by Mexican immigrants and organized by the Magonistas, who were half the victims at Ludlow, for example, were Mexican. And it wasn't just Mexicans. The Magonistas organized all the immigrants in the Southwest, particularly in the mines and the railroads and so on, regardless of language. And they're the only group historically I know of that was able to unite immigrant workers of at least 6, 7, 8 different languages, including Chinese, into a cohesive social movement and labor union movement in southwestern United States. This has not been duplicated, to my knowledge, anywhere else in the world. So the internationalism of the Magonistas was absolutely pivotal. They argued, especially Flores Magón himself and his articles in their newspaper, Regeneración, which was also funded by these nickels and dimes of Mexican workers, and that had a huge distribution. That's one thing they did achieve, 30,000 copies a year inside Mexico. And with an English language section, because of the internationalism for north of the border, they were able to display the philosophy that was later articulated by Leon Trotsky of permanent revolution. You cannot have revolution only in one country. They argued consistently that the revolution had to be worldwide, and especially in Mexico's case, had to be coordinated with the revolution in the United States. So they were internationalists, to answer your question, par excellence.
The Mexican Revolution lasted, in formal terms, from 1910 to 1917. You referred earlier to the new constitution that was adopted by the country in 1917. And you write that it was influenced by the Magonistas. What's the importance of this document?
Well, this is a historic document, theoretically still in effect today, although being broken constantly. As the earlier constitution under Juarez was broken by the Diaz dictatorship, so the revolutionary constitution of 1917 is broken by more recent governments, a new type of dictatorship, if you will. And the significance is it was the most progressive constitution in the world at the time it was approved. The irony is that its progressive elements, labor, land for the peasantry, land to the tiller, the communal land system protected, natural resources protected, oil, water, it all belongs to the Mexican people. And even Article 39, that the Mexican people have the right to overthrow the government if it doesn't behave itself, so to speak. So all of these elements in the Constitution of 1917 reflected the need of those who were calling the convention and trying to control the convention from getting out of control, namely the more counter-revolutionary elements within the Mexican Revolution, the so-called constitutionalists. That constitution laid the basis for continued social movement demands for genuine revolution. Unfortunately, the leadership at that time that had triumphed in the internal battles within the revolution evolved in a more counter-revolutionary way in the years ahead, with the exception of Lázaro Cárdenas in the 1930s. But the Constitution itself, they had to sign off on. The constitutionalists, as they were called, Carranza, Obregón, figures like that, had to sign off on that 1917 Constitution or risk losing again this internal battle within the revolution. That was enough to assuage some of the dissident elements, the more revolutionary elements at the Constitutional Convention in Querétaro, and allow the constitutionalists to consolidate power in the next few years. But they couldn't do it without assassinating first Zapata in 1919 and later Pancho Villa in the early 1920s.
There's so much history in this book, James, that we're going to be sort of skipping around a little bit. I want to actually move up to the 1930s. Because you write that in that decade, and this was kind of preceded by and involved with the worldwide Great Depression, in the 30s, there was a heated class war in Mexico between the elites and the state on the one hand, and the workers and peasants and radicals on the other. What did that class war force the Mexican elites to do? And how did they respond in a way that might recall what FDR did in the U.S.?
Well, it's interesting you mention FDR because his administration introduced the so-called good neighbor policy and gave the green light to Mexico to introduce some of the radical reforms that fulfilled the Constitution of 1917 in the middle and late 1930s in Mexico. So what happened was the elites divided again. They had more or less consolidated their rule, but the class war continued against them in the 1920s. And one way they were able to consolidate their rule in that period was by defending the nation against U.S. imperialism, as it was known. They waved the nationalist flag, if you will, and tried to defend national sovereignty. But they also made compromises with the empire to the north, And as a result, the class struggle and nationalism sharpened in the 20s and 30s. And then they split politically, and Cardenas, the incoming president, who launched his campaign with a visit to all the villages and cities of the nation, almost a walk-a-thon by Lázaro Cárdenas. When he got into office, he faced a real conflict because now the masses were aroused. That's why they voted for him. They expected changes. There were huge strikes going on. Even the women were protesting and so on and so forth. The women had always been very strong in the revolutionary currents in Mexico from the days of Flores Magón. The other key element in the PLM had been women, you know, women leaders. They were the only party that recruited women. And even Zapata had female comandantes or commanders. And, of course, Zapata, as I explained in the book, was influenced by these Magonistas who arrived in his camp, right down to his slogan, Land and Liberty. So by the 1930s, all of that ferment is escalating again, precisely because, again, another depression, just as the depression of 1907 helped generate the Mexican Revolution, so the depression of the 1930s helped generate the nationalism of Lázaro Cárdenas. So they split, and Cárdenas won the internal battle against the outgoing president, Calles, and he did it by promising both big business and organized labor that their demands would be met if they promised to cooperate with the state instead of divide and undermine the unity of the nation behind the revolution. This is a form of co-optation, in effect, but what it did is it rallied a lot of workers and peasants to his cause because they felt he was supporting some of their strikes.
He was a populist.
Yeah, he's a very effective populist. He was very similar to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was really the left-wing elements who were behind all the organizing at the base, and not for Cárdenas, just for class interest, just as it had been in the United States, particularly in the Deep South in the United States during the Roosevelt era. So this kind of populism flourished for a few years, and Cárdenas organized a new national party. Now, the party had been organized almost since 1917, and so we can effectively say this one-party system of Mexico had a history since the late 19-teens, and therefore is the longest ruling single party in modern history.
This is the PRI, the
eventually
institution.
It's called the PRI,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Eventually it's called the PRI, or the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party. Yes, T.S., you're right. And it gets named that a little after Cárdenas in the late 40s. But Cárdenas is the one who organized the sectors of the PRI that allowed it to become such a monolith. But what was interesting was he did have a business sector of sorts and a middle class sector or whatever, and even a military sector at that time. But the key sectors had to be the peasants and the workers. And instead of making it just working class Mexico, he made it workers here, peasants there. They were not allowed to unite, but they had been fighting to unify with each other ever since they had a very narrow split in 1915 that led to their defeat. Now they were unifying again, and so he was successful in keeping them divided into separate sectors of the state that would receive state support of some of their strikes and movements. He even armed some of the peasants against fascistic, sinarquista, pro-Germany, pro-Italy fascism elements that were prospering inside Mexico. So he had to arm peasants against them. It's a long story. But I want to conclude by saying that he was very popular with the masses. He was beloved of the masses. And when the oil workers kept up their year-and-a-half-long strike, demanding simply the most basic of worker demands, not too much for the capitalists to grant them, Cárdenas negotiated with the foreign owners of oil an agreement. And then the foreign owners asked Cárdenas to sign the agreement as if they didn't believe him or something. And this insulted his dignity. And meanwhile, the workers were saying, don't get bogged down in those negotiations. Nationalize now. And so when his dignity was insulted, he nationalized under pressure from below. And the whole nation rallied around the nationalization of oil. Even the Catholic Church that had supported the other side against Cardenas, and that was even supporting the fascists and sinarquistas, right? And had fought a war in the late 20s against the revolution, the Cristero Revolt. The Catholic Church supported the nationalization of oil. A marvelous moment, by the way, in human history. People gave their nickels and dimes to pay the indemnity to the oil companies. And even then, the oil companies blockaded economically Mexico for 2 or 3 years before a deal was struck to accept the indemnity and renew more equitable traditional relations.
Cardenas was president of Mexico from 1934 to 1940. And I should say, when James talks about the PLM, that's the Mexican Liberal Party, which was affiliated with the Magones, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Flores Magón himself died in Fort Leavenworth Prison in 1924, presumably assassinated.
Now, one of the many interesting things that the political and economic elites of Mexico did after the Mexican Revolution was to adopt an ideology that promoted the revolution, that looked back fondly on the revolution as opposed to something that was evil and terrible, and now we're so glad it's gone and those workers and peasants and everything are, you know, to be denied everything. And I'm very interested in the rhetoric and ideology surrounding the revolution that was taken up by elites, by the bourgeoisie.
Well, that's not unusual if you look at the history of countries in the last 3 or 4 centuries, including communist countries like that of the Soviet Union. The use of these revolutionary ideas to persuade the population that we're acting in your interests. You'll get echoes of that even in the United States with its heralding of the ideals of the American Revolution and so on and so forth. So in Mexico's case, it's a particularly deep process because it taps into earlier Mexican history, not just the revolution of 1917. It taps into the pride and dignity of all Mexicans who fought in all those wars of liberation against the Spaniards, against the U.S. invasion and occupation of 1846 to 1848, against the French takeover of Maximilian, of the emperor, in the late 50s, early 60s of the 19th century, and against imperialism and dictatorship in the revolution of 1917 when the U.S. invaded Mexico twice, 1914 and 1916. So all that tradition is what the triumphant elements within the revolutionary camp play on after 1917. And that's a very persuasive ideology, very useful, not just in the media, but at the very ground level, so to speak, on the ground, right, in persuading workers and peasants and middle-class people to go along with whatever the state is doing. But as you know, when people are poor or downwardly mobile, as in the case of some of the middle classes today and back then in the Great Depression of the 1930s, people get angry and they fight back and they say, well, you know, we've heard you say this, but what are you delivering? Where's the meat, or whatever the saying is in this country of the United States? You know, where's the beef or whatever? And nowadays they say, where's the tortilla? Because prices have jumped so high on tortillas now you can't afford them. So that kind of anger then gets channeled by organizers and individuals from below with or without success. And in the case of Mexico, it was often taken over by the governing party, the PRI, and channeled into some reforms. Not just with nationalization of oil. There were even agrarian reforms in the 1950s, by the way. They weren't very profound, but they served to cool out angry elements of the population. So this is called co-optation and control. It's co-optation because it's clientelism. You essentially buy out the dissenters. Either economically, you actually give them money, or with reforms that they're demanding. And then it's called control because it works as a control nonviolently by introducing or echoing, I should say, the ideals of the Mexican Revolution, which becomes part of Mexico's political culture to the present. Now, the other form of control is repression. And so you get acts of really violent repression against dissident elements who are not willing to accept their co-optation. And this happened even under Cardenas. He ended up crushing strikes violently after the nationalization of oil. And then, of course, there's more serious violent acts of repression against the railroad workers in the 1950s and the students in 1968, and then the dirty war of the 1970s and right up to the present, where they're violently repressing all dissidents in Mexico.
On our website, againstthegrain.org, you'll find a link to my guest's homepage on the web. My guest is James Cockcroft, and his latest book is Mexico's Revolution Then and Now. Caciquismo. You indicate in your book that this tradition had been used by the Spanish and has been adopted as well by the Mexican authorities to co-opt, and we're continuing on this theme of co-optation, to co-opt peasants and indigenous people. Tell us how it works.
Well, initially the Spaniards took the cacique system of the Indians, where the cacique was a jefe or leader of the Indian group, whether it's a linguistic group or a geographical group. He's the jefe, the boss, the cacique. And in traditional Indian cultures, the cacique had to be a good cacique or the people would remove him. Well, under the Spaniards, they used caciquismo. They would buy out some of these caciques. And then as they introduced more and more white Spanish power with a racist system that was against Indians, they would try to establish not just Indian caciques who would support their projects, and they were pretty good at doing that. Those who weren't co-opted were killed, you know, that's what I mean about co-optation or repression. And they were pretty good at creating mestizo caciques as well, mixed blood, so-called elements of African, Indian, Spanish, and other nationalities, Asian. So to jump it up to the 20th century and today, what happens with caciquismo is it works to a certain degree, especially during the Cardenas years. And shortly after, I would have to say, it was pretty successful in the countryside of Mexico. It helped build an industrial state in Mexico, an industrial economy, a semi-industrialized country compared to the United States, but nonetheless an industrialized country on the backs of overexploited peasants. And it was because those caciques in the countryside, don't forget, Mexico was predominantly rural in 1940, it was on the backs of those peasants that they were able to industrialize Mexico, because they gave the peasants some guaranteed prices on the products, and they delivered some reforms for the peasantry, even with the agrarian reform in the 50s. And even though that was a very conservative period, after Cardenas especially, it seemed very conservative, it was a use of caciques, often corrupt, by the way, totally corrupted and integrated with an increasingly corrupt political party, that they were able to accomplish so much economically for the elites and the oligarchy. Well, by 1968, where the roots of today's revolts are most vividly lived in human beings, because they're still alive, okay? In 1968 commences this huge process of almost half a century now of attacking caciquismo and people trying to get rid of the bad caciques the way the original Indian peoples used to do. You simply replace them, but not too easy to do when they're so linked to the state and the power of the military and so on in Mexico. So it's very hard to get rid of this caciquismo. But we characterize it by co-optation, corruption, terrible corruption to such a degree that all the revolts since 68 and all the social movements have been in the name of combating caciquismo.
The history of Mexico, you write, can only be understood by grasping what Leon Trotsky called the law of uneven and combined development. What do you mean by that? What did Trotsky mean by that law, and how has that been followed or not in Mexico?
Leon Trotsky, the Bolshevik revolutionary, referred to the law of uneven and combined development, by which he meant the drawing together of different stages of historical processes, a combining of separate and disparate steps, quote, an amalgam of archaic with more contemporary forms, end quote. Tarski saw this law as especially applicable in those parts of the world less fully developed economically than Europe, or unevenly developed in their adaptation of and subjugation by capitalist forms of production. He concluded that the Russian Revolution, based upon a worker-peasant alliance, would combine stages of earlier human history, passing in a very brief time from industrial and pre-industrial, bourgeois and pre-bourgeois forms of social organization to socialist ones. Well, that was also his theory of permanent revolution and the impossibility of socialism in only one country. Flores Magón understood all of that earlier before Trotsky formulated it. And Flores Magón also understood before Trotsky the need to internationalize the revolutionary process. He realized that the Mexican countryside was not feudal. It wasn't feudalism. Therefore, a bourgeois revolution against feudalism was not needed. That's why the Magonistas called for the immediate seizure of the means of production in the countryside and not just in the cities. And in truth, Mexico has long experienced an uneven and combined development of modern capitalist forms of production with harsh and dictatorial forms of control over the population. It's important to understand that combined and uneven process in Mexico because it illuminates these realities you and I have been talking about in the interview.
James Cockcroft is his name. His latest book is Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, published by Monthly Review Press. We'll take a short break and speak more with James. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. James Cockcroft has written Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, his latest book. Well, James, you were talking about the foreign oil companies who were rebuffed by Cardenas' nationalization of the country's oil industry. You were talking about the fact that a lot of Mexico's land, a significant percentage of Mexico's land, was controlled by U.S. investors at the time of the Mexican Revolution. What else needs to be said about the role that foreign capital and debts have played in shaping Mexico's economic growth and the decision-making on economic matters in Mexico over the decades?
Well, the most recent example of foreign capitals twisting Mexico's arm in order to get more ownership of natural resources and more exploitation of inexpensive Mexican labor inside Mexico is the whole 32 years of neoliberalism, what I call gradual economic genocide, in Mexico since 1982, actually, to be give it a date, but roughly 30 years. And NAFTA accentuated it. Even before NAFTA came in, the president who stole the election of 1988 from the true winner, who was a left-of-center candidate, but the official party stole the election and burned the ballots, that president privatized the ejidos. He got the rubber stamp Congress of the PRI to approve a constitutional reform that allowed ejidatarios, owners of ejidos, the peasantry, of communal ejido lands, to sell those lands. And because they were undergoing a recession after the collapse of the peso in 1982, which is another example of your question, how the debt is used. I'll get to that in a minute. The peasants did indeed begin to sell off their ejidal parcels. So eventually under NAFTA, 2 million of them have to leave the countryside. They cannot survive anymore. So NAFTA accentuates the use of the debt and the use of foreign capital to essentially suck the blood out of the Mexican economy for the benefit of foreign investors at the cost of the masses. Now, the debt actually has a long history in Mexico, and periodically Mexican revolutionaries would call for its cancellation. Flores Magón was eloquent in calling for the cancellation of the debt under Porfirio Diaz, the dictator. And subsequent revolutionaries have echoed those demands. The 1920s witnessed intense negotiations between the governing party of Mexico and the foreign investment community to the north and in Europe. And there's an earlier history that I won't go into in colonial times. But what it means is the debt, if you trace out the history, was always used to get something out of the indebted country. So it's, in a sense, loaning money in order to really turn the screws on that country later. Some people who don't like bankers say that's what bankers do. Well, that's another story. Anyway, unfortunately for Mexico, the debt has been used repeatedly to get more concessions out of the oligarchy, its political party, and its government in Mexico City on behalf of foreign capital. Now, obviously, the oligarchy benefits, too, if it's willing to cooperate with foreign capital. And that's what happened in this more recent period of the use of the debt, of neoliberalism, when Salinas, the president who stole the 1988 election, began to privatize everything. He gave away state sectors like telecommunications and telephone company to his buddies at bargain basement prices. And one of those buddies is the richest man in the world last year, I think, and certainly the richest man in Mexico today, Carlos Slim, you know, the telecommunications magnate. So this kind of corruption in the name of privatization and private enterprise and free markets actually cannot occur without a strong state. And that's why the Mexican central government is so powerful. And, of course, constitutionally, it was made a strong state also, giving the executive branch tremendous power. So, on the one hand, it led to some good things like Cárdenas being able to grant some of the worker and peasant demands and reclaim national sovereignty with the nationalization of oil. But on the other hand, a strong state also makes it possible for presidents like Salinas and his successors in the new governing party, the PAN, which theoretically is opposed to the old party, the PRI, but they have a kind of PRI-AN alliance, they call it, because it's PRI-AN, Acción Nacional, which is the National Action Party in power today in Mexico. So this use of a strong state can also be used to deliver national sovereignty lock, stock, and barrel over to foreigners, which is what the recent governments have been doing.
Now, you write that the rules of the electoral game were changed in the 1990s in Mexico as a result of social protest movements, pro-democracy movements. And then if you look at the election of 2000, some might argue that, well, one-party rule in Mexico ended that year. The pre-candidate for president lost the election. Does that argument make sense to you?
No. First of all, the democratic movements are what led to the democratic victory of 1988, so they predate the 90s. Of course, the winning candidate had the election stolen, as I explained. But the democratic movement continued in the 90s, and therefore the goal of both Washington and the oligarchy inside Mexico was to finally recognize that something had to be done about this democratic movement. What better way to do something than to finally end the rule of the PRI and let a conservative party take over? Now, that conservative party had always been the loyal opposition, whereas the democratic movement came from leftist elements who only through their own social movements, finally got themselves legalized as political parties somewhere along in the 80s, and therefore didn't have much strength compared to this loyal opposition of the National Action Party that had been there since the late 30s and had its roots, by the way, in the fascists and the sinarquistas and the reactionary branches of the Catholic Church.
Again, this is the pan that rules today.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's why, of course, and then the mass media were controlled by these PRI and PAN forces, and the left wing had no voice in the mass media. So that's why a lot of people who had been in those movements of the 80s and 90s for democracy, a lot of those people said, well, we're not going to be able to get our candidate of choice in. We learned that in 1988. We'll give what's called the voto útil, the useful vote, to the less of the evils, because by then the PRI was considered so evil that the PAN seemed the least of the evils. And bingo, we have the PAN ever since 2000. But, C.S., you should know that the PRI is not out of the electoral equation just because they lost the last two presidential elections. They're expected, actually, by most surveys, to win the 2012 presidential election.
My guest, James Cockcroft, has a blog on the web. We have a link to that on againstthegrain.org. The first chapter of your book compares the two periods, 1900 and 1910, with the period 2000 to 2010. What are the key parallels you see? Because I think we're really addressing the title of your book, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, that there's something about what happened way back then that is extraordinarily relevant to movements and developments today.
Well, after the 2006 stolen election,
where Obrador,
López Obrador won, and then the Electoral Council, in a post-midnight, pre-dawn decision, suddenly found 500,000 to 2 million votes for Calderón and zero for Obregón in different parts of the country. It was a trickery thing, a fraud, and stole the election. At that point, Calderón could be inaugurated only under military guard because the Congress was occupied by the people. Over 1 million people occupied the main streets of Mexico City between July and September of that year of 2006. So that movement is not dead. That movement is alive today, but it's been repressed ever since. And it's been repressed under the guise of a anti-narco war, anti-drug war. 40,000 civilians have died in this bloody war, most of them innocent, half of them youth, over 1,000 of them children, and it has gotten so bad that many of the conservative citizens who had voted for Calderón and supported the war at first have now turned against it, and that's why he's losing so much popularity. There's a new movement that some people are comparing to the Arab Spring in Mexico today called No More Blood. It had 50,000 in the streets just last April 6th of Cuernavaca, and 25,000 in Mexico City, and several thousands more in at least 25 other states of the Mexican Republic. And I should point out that the killing of civilians is done by both narco gangs and the military of Mexico and their paramilitary goons supporting reactionary governors and so on. Out of that came the Oaxaca Commune of 2006, right? And it's repression later that year, and this war declared by Calderón. Now, just before Calderón was inaugurated, he held private meetings with right-wing thinkers and people from Washington. 14 documents from those private meetings were released by the Calderón government recently. And in those documents, which are described literally as part of Plan Mexico 2030 Global Vision, I suggest people Google it to get the details line by line, are revealed the agreement between Calderón and Washington to finish off the annexation of Mexico economically by the United States and politically, and if need be, militarily. Okay, that's why Calderon also has a proposed law before the Mexican Congress to allow a massive infusion of foreign troops, i.e. United States troops, into Mexico. Now, a small number of those troops are already there inside Mexico. And Mexico itself is militarized. But to get back to the No More Blood movement of April 6, what that came from was when one individual again, a famous poet, Javier Sicilia, yes, lost his son, Juan Presente, in an execution style preceded by torture, murder of his son and six friends of his son, because allegedly some narco gang was after them for having bad-mouthed them at a bar, whatever that story means. So this poet called for April 6 and No More Blood. And the No More Blood movement actually had tried demonstrations in February that weren't as successful, but by now, people who earlier had supported Calderon joined the demonstrations against the war, calling for the troops to return to their barracks, for Calderon either to step down or call off the war entirely and so on, and for a new Mexico. So this joins the earlier social movements in Oaxaca of the indigenous peoples, the Zapatistas in Chiapas and elsewhere, women's movements, student movements, labor movements above all, are now part of the equation. No More Blood had new demonstrators in the streets, joined by some of those demonstrators from the movements I just listed, including the Brigadistas of López Obrador. So what will come out of that is very interesting. But Calderón's response was to repress them more. So this violence of the last 4 years has actually all along been directed against activists in the social movements. That's the main point. And human rights defenders and journalists who tell the truth. That's why you have such a high rate of assassinations of journalists, for example, in Mexico. Practically the world record.
So what about immigrants? What role do immigrants play in the social movements that you've described that are beginning perhaps to blossom in some sense in Mexico?
Well, I'm not sure how much the movements are blossoming because of the violent repression, but I can certainly tell you that the immigration movement here in the United States, which has been pretty much sparked by Mexican immigrants over the years, is alive and well on both sides of the border, even as it was back in 1905 to 1910 when Flores Magón actually said that if you crush the Mexican Revolution, big capital will triumph, and the immigration problem will become worse than ever because our people will have to go north for jobs, and that will have a downward pressure on the wages of the American working people. He wrote all that 100 years ago. The situation's not so different today. What's interesting is that I serve, by the way, on Civil Society's Tribunal of Peoples of Conscience in Movement, which is an international tribunal defending the rights of every human being to have human rights, including immigrants, in other words. It focuses on immigrants. And now there's this movement, international in scope, linking the immigrants in the United States to the immigrants from Central America and Mexico. And they had a huge caravan November 2010 to counter-demonstrate against the meeting of presidents in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Over 1,000 people participated in that lengthy caravan that came all the way from Central America and through Mexico City and over to Western Mexico. And that's just the beginning, because we've had more demonstrations on that scale in front of the American embassy almost on a weekly basis around immigrant rights issues. And not just Mexican immigrants in the United States, but Central American immigrants being killed and put in mass graves in Mexico en route to the United States. And the immigrant movement, or the civil rights movement of immigrants here in the United States, because it is a civil rights movement, by the way, linked with the Madison protesters from Madison, Wisconsin, as you know. So there's a lot in the book about this, and people, I think, in the United States should be linking up with the organized labor struggles as the United Steelworkers are doing in the United States with the miners in Mexico, and with the immigrant struggle on both sides of the border, which is what Flores Magón called for in the first place, because you're not going to have much chance to change things in either country if you don't unite. So I would just like to add that about the immigrants. It's very, very important, and also that we should link up with the No More Blood movement. No more blood in Mexico, no more blood in Afghanistan, in Libya, wherever it may be in the world.
And that's the voice of James Cockcroft, internet professor for the State University of New York, a prominent poet, a veteran activist. He is based in Montreal. We're delighted to have him join us in our Berkeley studios. And his latest book is Mexico's Revolution Then and Now. Links to that book on againstthegrain.org. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio. And it's the most reliable way, I hear, to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And you can also visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Franklin Sterling, who's at the controls today.